Numbers 21:4-9. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us out to Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and the many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look up to it and live." So Moses made a brown snake and put it on the pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived.
Good morning. Grace and peace to you from God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. Just returned from Bluffton, Ohio, where we spent a few days at the Ohio Conference Annual Assembly with Larry and Evan and Justin and John. Greg was there for the missional conference, and it was a rich, worshipful and instructive days. One of the big things we talked about was, what does it mean to be on mission in the church? And I hope that's something that we can come back to here in the next year. So our scripture for today comes from the book of Numbers. Anyone find anything uncomfortable about this passage? Yeah. So I start, a lot of times I'll start with a passage on Tuesday and start getting into the passage. And a lot of times you arrive with a number of questions, and many times many of those questions are resolved. You get deeper into the text. Start kind of thinking on your own and seeing what other people have seen in the text, and many of those questions are resolved. I think for this week, the two kind of descriptions of how I rest in this text would be terrifying and puzzling. And I had the interesting experience, the Israelites do a lot of things that are not very smart during this wandering in the desert. But I actually found by the end of the week, my sympathy had broke with the Israelites. I found myself really deeply sympathetic with their plight. So we're in a theme in the season of Lent on covenant. And just to back up a little bit, the first covenant we looked at was between God and Noah, and this was a covenant for all creation. This is when God hung up the bow, when God said that destroying creation would no longer be an option. And this set in motion then, how is God going to redeem the world? If destroying the world is not an option, how will God redeem the world? And the next week we turn to the covenant with Abraham. And we saw that God is going to do this through a new family. He's going to give them land. He's going to make them as multiple as the stars in the sky. And then last week, I didn't preach on it because we had a guest preacher, but the covenant was the covenant between these new people of God, this family of God, and God. And he had given them these laws, these Ten Commandments, and the Israelites had committed to following that law. And in return, God would be with the people. So we've kind of taken these really big, giant leaps through the Old Testament as we go towards Lent, but it gives us a little bit of a kind of a 10,000-foot view of the Old Testament. So the scene picks up today in the desert, and this little trek of the Israelites is now almost in its 40th year. So we have a generation of people stuck in the wilderness, stuck between this promise of God and the fulfillment of the promise. And I have to think at some point the Israelites began to wonder, what exactly did we agree to here? What was the fine print on the back of those two tablets with those Ten Commandments? Many of you might remember the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I remember it as a kid, and there's just to give you a little synopsis, it's about a young boy named Charlie who finds this golden ticket in a chocolate bar, and he gets a tour then of this factory and a lifetime supply of chocolate. But before the kids can enter into the factory, they have to sign this contract. And it's this great scene where this curtain opens, and Willy Wonka presents this contract, and at first there's all these big words, and by the end it's just totally unlegible, like you cannot read what is in the contract. And Wonka says, if you don't sign, you don't go in. So during the tour of the factory, they run into all these interesting things like a chocolate river, lickable wallpaper, and all these sweets. And one by one, these kids who are in the factory find themselves knocked out of basically this competition to get a lifetime supply of chocolate. And even Charlie, the kind of the main character in the story, makes a mistake, and he and his dad drink the fizzy lifting drink, which is this drink that then they bloat up and they rise to the ceiling, and they almost get killed by this exhaust fan. And so at the end, they're still alive, and they go to Willy Wonka to ask about their lifetime supply of chocolate. And Wonka says, you signed the contract. It's all black and white as crystal. You stole the fizzy lifting drinks, and you bumped into the ceiling, and therefore you get nothing. And that's what Wonka tells him. And I feel like this phrase, you get nothing, kept coming into my mind this week. This generation of people who started making these mistakes and is now being lost. This whole generation between Exodus and the promise is dying. There's not many of them left. And to be fair, they did complain a lot. This story in Numbers is the seventh complaint story that they had done on this Exodus, on this journey. And a lot of it revolved around food. So they started complaining. You know, when we first are introduced to manna, in Exodus, this bread from heaven. This is the wafer-like bread that would come down in the middle of the night, and they'd wake up, and there would be manna, and they would have that as their food every day except for the Sabbath. And that was God's provision for the people. And the first description in Exodus is of it tasting like honey, which is this nice kind of description. By the time we get to Numbers, it's described as cakes baked with oil. So the people were longing for the rich food of Egypt. I've spent a couple weeks in the wilderness eating mostly ramen noodles and macaroni and cheese, which I'm sure some of you have. And I found, particularly when I was in high school, that the second week my mind was completely consumed with food. I wasn't getting enough calories. I think I was burning. I was up in the Rockies doing some mountaineering stuff. I wasn't burning enough, and I just was consumed with food. I was dreaming about burgers and shakes and fries. And interestingly, I saw this is 40 years, and the Israelites are not dreaming about burgers and shakes and fries, but they're dreaming about meat and fish and melons and leeks and onions and cucumbers and garlic. And at one point along the journey, it's interesting, the Israelites actually begin to refer to Egypt as the land of milk and honey. Let's think about this for a minute. This is a place where they spent 400 years in slavery. And now in the desert, they're becoming so disoriented that the land of milk and honey actually looks like that place where they were enslaved. The wilderness seems to have completely disoriented the Israelites. And they cry out to God. They cry out to Moses and God, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no food and water. And besides, we detest this miserable food. So did you catch that? There's no food in this place. In any case, we detest this miserable food. Are the Israelites hallucinating? Are they going now mad in the desert all this time they've spent? And there seems to be some kind of breaking point here because in all these other complaint stories, they complain to Moses but never to God. And this is the last one, probably the last reason why is the last complaint story. They complain to God. And the Israelites say, they want to go, they have this kind of back to Egypt moment. They want to go back to Egypt. I'm wondering, has anyone here ever had a let's go back to Egypt moment? I know when I've thought about my life, I've definitely had some let's go back to Egypt moments. Where you come to something in your life where you have a choice, you can move forward into the unpredictable, or you can go back to something that was predictably bad. Now, I know that sounds strange, but I have certainly experienced that myself. There's something, the scariness of the unknown sounds worse than going to a situation that you know will be bad, but it's predictably bad. I don't think it's quite as absurd as it first sounds. So I'm sympathetic with the Israelites, and I also found myself sympathetic with Moses. 40 years guiding these people in the wilderness. I mean, I've guided youth on trips, four-day trips in the wilderness. I've guided my family on trips. That's four or five people. This is several hundreds of thousands of people that are complaining to Moses that this journey stinks. You know, it's no wonder that Moses, just before this, snaps and hits his staff on the rock for the water. The Israelites are not the only ones on edge here. Moses is on edge too. Last year, I read this story in the paper, which was kind of bizarre, not something I'm encouraging, but there's these businesses in these major metropolitan areas that have set up anger rooms where you can pay money, and they'll get you all this stuff set up in a room, laptops or computers and furniture, and they'll hand you a baseball bat, and you can go to town on it. And you pay money to do this, and the owner says the objective is, one, to have fun, and two, to work something out. So I'm sure these people in Dallas and New York City and Toronto have some things to work out, but I doubt it was anything like Moses. You know, so hitting the rock a couple times with the staff to release some anger, I'm a little bit sympathetic to. After that mistake, Moses then finds out that he will not be entering the promised land. And then come the snakes. The people look up, and there's a pack of poisonous snakes that has moved into camp. Let's imagine this for a minute. We've got the doors closed here. Just imagine snakes moving in here. Yeah. I'm not a jumpy person. I don't find myself typically fearful of that, and it makes my skin crawl. If I really let myself in my office think about these snakes coming at me, it was terrifying, because when I bump into one snake in the woods, even if you know it's a non-poisonous snake, it makes you jump. And I know someone in the line is going to tell me how much they love snakes. You are an anomaly, okay? I know that's coming. There it is, Max. I knew. I even guessed you. But you are not the norm. And I mean that the best way, Max. So I've been attacked by wasps. I've been almost trampled by cattle. I've been wrestled pigs trying to get them in a trailer. I've gone to battle with raccoons and possums that were killing my chickens. I've stumbled within a few feet of a black bear in Wyoming. I've been to the ER with my daughter who was bit by a dog. And when I think about all these animals, I feel no animosity. I don't feel any fear. I don't feel any resentment towards any of these animals. Nothing like I feel towards the snake. The creature that has not once harmed me, that has not even once gotten close to harming me. This is not a rational fear. I saw an article in the paper actually this week that between 2008 and 2015, 610 people were killed by animals. 478 were killed by hornets, wasps, and bees. 272 killed by dogs. And 6 people died of snake bites. So we are much, 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 much more likely to be killed by a bee than a snake. And I've been attacked by bees. I'm sure people like Larry who have kept bees have had bees kind of turn on them for a little bit. I feel no animosity towards bees. And I'm not alone in this fear of snakes, because I read another poll that 36% of adults list snakes as their number one fear. And people even capitalize off this. There's a movie which I've never seen called Snakes on a Plane, which is about, yeah, somebody in here has seen it. So it's about snakes being released into a plane. And the whole thing is that it's terrifying because you're trapped with all the snakes. Like somehow like bees on a plane or dogs on a plane, it just doesn't have the same effect. You know, that just would not be the same commercial success. There's something deep within us, I think, kind of ancient within us that I think is afraid of snakes, that sends us back into the Garden of Eden, when the serpent got the best of us. And so if I had sympathy for the Israelites before, I definitely have sympathy for the Israelites now. Next thing, God's response. This is the puzzling part for me. If that was a terrifying part of the story, this is the puzzling part. Larry, could you put up the slide from Numbers 21? Just want to look at this again here. So, then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. Thanks, Larry. So the people ask God, take away these snakes. But God doesn't actually take away the snakes. Instead, he tells Moses to erect this pole with this bronze statue of a serpent on it. And God says to the people, look at the serpent and you will live. So wait a minute, there's a pole being erected with a bronze statue. Does that sound a little bit like an idol? And there's a statue of a snake. And didn't Pharaoh wear a headdress with a cobra on it? And then look at the pole and live. Doesn't that smack just a little bit of magic? That's not exactly how God's healing is supposed to work. And the cure for a snake is a snake. That which strikes fear in your heart is what then saves them. So what I want you to just reflect on for a minute here is a question you may not want to ask, but I'm asking you to just think about it. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? Some of you might be afraid of snakes like me, but what are you? That's a little bit of a, at least myself, irrational fear. What are we really afraid of? So one of the things about Lent, we take these 6 weeks in Lent, and we're invited to kind of enter into our own wilderness experience. And we take time to stop and reflect and examine and look deep. And one of the things that is asked of us in Lent is to look at our own sin and brokenness. But I also saw in this text an invitation to look at what is our fear. What are you afraid of? Let me pull out two. There's a lot we could say about fears, but let me pull out two fears I saw. There's the back to Egypt fears. So those are the fears that I think that we have a hard time letting go of. Those are the fears that we hold close to us, that we're aware of. We know we have these fears, and in fact, they almost act as this kind of comfort, this kind of security blanket for us. They're predictable. They're not pleasant, but they're predictable. And sometimes I think we actually use those fears as a way of trying to protect us from what we fear. I mean, have you ever, this might just be me, but I've thought on times where I haven't heard from my wife, she's not receiving my text or she's not receiving, and I think, if I can think about this fear, if I can be fearful enough about what's happened, I can somehow get around what I think, what I'm fearing has happened. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but like, if I can actually be fearful enough, then I'll avoid that which I'm afraid of. I think one of the questions this text asks us is, what would it be like to pull out those fears? What would it be like to pull out those fears and put them on a pole? Sometimes I think we've held on to certain fears so long that we'd almost rather keep holding on to them because they're familiar than putting them up on that pole and striking out into the unknown. So that's the first type of fear, the go back to Egypt fear. The other fear that I thought about is the wilderness fear. I'm sure if you've ever had a chance to get away, we have a lot of noise in our society today. I think most of us experience. And if you've ever gone away, actually this wilderness trip I took in high school, totally shut off from music, from everything. And I had the strange experience of my second week, all these weird songs coming in my head. Like songs I hadn't thought about 10, 15 years were kind of coming back in my head. It was like when all the noise was taken away, all this stuff that was in me, that's in there, was coming out. And sometimes that can be a scary experience. When we invited our interns to our farm, we were out kind of in the middle of nowhere. You spent a lot of time doing handwork, weeding strawberries. And there was this familiar pattern that I began to see. A lot of times people would arrive from college, you know, busy, lots of noise, and all of a sudden you got to stop. There's not many ways to distract yourself. And all of a sudden you have a lot of time to think. And more than one occasion, I saw someone begin to wrestle something that had been deep within them for a long time and was starting to come out. It's kind of this what happens when you're in the wilderness for long enough. And my question about that one is, what does it mean to bring that fear out of the darkness, out of the shadows, and into the light? And part of us kind of knows that this is part of the healing process. I'm not a psychologist, but I think even most of us that are not kind of know this is part of healing, is bringing something from the dark into the light. It has this way of kind of defanging it. So that fear is deep within us. There's something about just pulling it out and just naming it and saying, I'm scared of that. That has the ability to take away a little bit of its power. When I was a volunteer firefighter, we went on a scene which was a horrible accident, and it was one of the worst things I'd ever seen. And the fire chief brought in a chaplain to talk with us, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with this. The first thing he did was we just talked about it. We talked about the scene minute by minute. You know, it doesn't sound like what you normally do, but you know it's there. You know the trauma of seeing that, whatever trauma you experience is there. And a lot of times what somebody needs to do is get that out in the open and to talk about it, to go through that scene minute by minute. And there's something healing about that. We even understand that when we go to the hospital. I think Rich and Sarah could relate to this, that before the healing can begin, the doctor has to inflict pain. That there's something about that pain that then leads to healing. So I guess one of my invitations to you this Lenten season is to think about this. Is there any fears? Are there any back to Egypt fears that you've maybe held on to so long and become comfortable that maybe it's time to let those go? Maybe it's time to put those up on the pole and just try to experience life without those. Or if there's any wilderness fears that we need to pull up and put on the pole and look through those and see God. See the true power is not in that fear, but in the God behind that fear. If you were to travel to, you want to put up the next slide, Larry? If you were to travel to, and I'd be interested to ask Adam if he saw this, but if you were to travel to Israel today, Mount Nebo is, this is what you'd see on top of Mount Nebo. So if you look out on that mountain, this is the last view that Moses had. So Moses was told he was not going to see the promised land, and God brings him up on this mountain. And the last thing he did was look out at the promised land, the land that he would never enter, this land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in addition to that view, you see this statue. This is a tall, hammered metal sculpture by the Italian artist Giovanni Fantoni. And it features this a serpent wrapped around a bronze pole. And the kind of the loop of the serpent's head actually, as you can kind of see, forms it, what looks like a person's head. And then, of course, the outstretched arms make it look like a cross. So on a clear day, apparently 46 kilometers away, you would see Jerusalem. And if it's clear, you could see Jerusalem. And on the other side is the wilderness, is the place where this serpent was lifted up. And this artist brought these two places together, because this is what connects these two passages today. Jesus referring to this snake lifted up in the cross, and Moses lifting up the snake in the wilderness. Thanks, Larry. I think there's a passage from John then. So the only reason we are looking at this pretty bizarre passage is because John decided to record a line that none of the other gospel writers decided to record. In a conversation, Nicodemus, if you remember, goes to Jesus in the middle of the night, and I'm not sure if it's he wants a long conversation or if he's afraid of others of seeing him, but he goes to Jesus, and this is what Jesus sees. And we're so familiar with John 3:16, I sometimes forget that what precedes John 3:16 is a very strange line. So I'll read that again. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. So in this passage, Jesus likens himself to the bronze serpent in the wilderness. Jesus says, just as that serpent had to be lifted up, so I will have to be lifted up, so that anyone who looks at me can be saved. And if you think about it, this is a really odd comparison. I mean, there's lots of different things you could do where it's like, oh, that doesn't, I don't get that. But in some ways, it is a very apt comparison. Because you know what? I think what's so terrifying about that snake is that it's such a strange tool for healing. Here it is, this ugly snake on a pole, and that is what gives life to them. And now Jesus is comparing himself to that, the cross to that pole. It sounds like a messy, strange way of offering healing to people. It sounds a little bit like using mud and saliva to cure the blind, or to take an instrument that's used for capital punishment and use that to then be a tool to bring salvation to the world. And as I began to think about the two sides of the cross, the side of the cross that I tend to go to is the side of glory, is the side of conquering, is the image of Jesus as one who used the cross to conquer death, to defeat Satan, and defeat sin. That is the side of the cross that offers healing and salvation. And I think sometimes what we lose is the perspective that the early Christians had, that the disciples had, that when they looked up at that cross, how bizarre that would be. It's a little bit like how bizarre it is for us to look at a pole with a snake's head on it and think, that's what's going to bring about healing? I think it helps us understand why his disciples were so confused. This was a form of capital punishment, a political weapon of the Roman Empire used for slaves and rebels and the particularly despised. And this weapon of the cross was used to send a message. When the Roman Empire would crucify people, they would make sure to do it in public areas, usually when there was a road going by it, so that the masses of people would be forced to walk by those crosses, and they would see the frightening power of the state. And they would receive one message: don't mess with us, or you'll find yourself hanging on one of these crosses yourself. So while for me, while I find inspiration and comfort from the cross today, and rightfully so, when they would have looked at this cross, it would have struck unimaginable fear in them. Fear that I think it's very hard for us to get our minds around. It was more than execution, it was humiliation. It was the most shameful and disgraceful way a person could die. The goal was not only to kill the body, it was to dishonor the body. Crucifixion was so shameful that a Roman citizen was usually exempted from it. They would be killed in other ways. And it was, of course, gruesome, ghastly, and excruciating. This is actually where we get the word excruciating, which means out of crucifying. So that's where we get the description of pain, excruciating. Cicero, a Roman lawyer and politician, described crucifixion as a most cruel and disgusting punishment. The very mention of the cross should be far removed, not only from a Roman citizen's body, but from his mind, his eyes, and his ears. In other words, banish the cross. Don't look at it. Don't think about it. Don't talk about it. Banish the cross. This is the instrument that Jesus said, look and live. Look up at the cross and live. Lift your eyes to this terrifying, shameful, cruel instrument of death, and there you will find life. There you will find healing and salvation. It is the mystery of the cross. It is what we still stand before the cross 2,000 years later in mystery. It's dreadful and fearful, and yet it's been transformed into a symbol of love and healing and salvation. The cure for a snake is a snake. The cure for all human life is one man's life. The cure for death is death. The healing the Israelites experienced in the wilderness was only possible when they looked through the tear of the snake on the pole. The joy and victory and hope of Easter and resurrection could only be fully understood when we look through the tear of the cross in Good Friday.